Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, at last, the election, and an outcome that left many searching for words. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said Barack Obama's election to the presidency would help heal wounds.
As an African American, I'm especially proud because this is a country that's been through a long journey in terms of overcoming wounds and making race not the factor in our lives.
President Bush, who will host the Obamas on Monday, felt the historic moment.
It'll be a stirring sight to watch President Obama, his wife Michelle, and their beautiful girls step through the doors of the White House.
And in Atlanta, a voter shed tears of joy.
It wasn't stolen this time. Every vote counted. Everybody turned. The numbers couldn't lie. There was no way to deny us. This time, we got it. This is our America. This is it. Oh.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join us. What have we seen? What have we learned this week about America? And would you want the job Barack Obama is about to take on? Joining us today from Albany, New York, is Deborah Dickerson, writer and blogger for Mother Jones Magazine. She's author of The End of Blackness. Deborah, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom. Glad to be back.
Great to have you with us. Joining us from Dallas, Texas, is our old friend Bill McKenzie, editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Bill, great to have you here.
Hello, Tom. Jack, Deborah.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Bill, and Deborah.
Let's listen straight away to a little bit, just once more, of Barack Obama Tuesday night, election night in Chicago, saying his win proves America's ideals are still strong.
And to all those who have wondered if America's beacon still burns as bright, tonight we proved once more that the true strength of our nation comes not from the might of our arms or the scale of our wealth, but from the enduring power of our ideals, democracy, liberty, opportunity, and unyielding hope.
The next morning, CNN's Hugh Remington spoke with Colin Powell. Powell choked up, describing the moment when the newscasters declared Obama's win.
So I have to share in the pride that all Americans have now for the fact that America did this. And as I watched it, as I watched finally, one of the newscasters cut to the chase and said, he's won, it's over. Pretty moving moment.
There was a tear.
Everybody cried.
And on Thursday, Republican National Committee Chairman Mike Duncan said Obama's victory was primarily because of his huge money advantage, not a political advantage.
Those facts do refute absolutely the preposterous idea that this election represents a mandate for another New Deal or the death rattle of Republican conservatism.
No New Deal, said the Republican leader there. No death rattle for Republican conservatism. Bill McKenzie, let us come to you in Dallas first. You're a staunch Republican, conservative, I should say, supporter of John McCain. You've watched this week. What do you make of it, Bill? What have you seen unfold here?
Well, I will say first, as a moderate who liked John McCain's moderation, I think this is a great moment for America. And the cultural aspect of Barack Obama has always been the most appealing. And this is a, as everybody has said, as the setup pieces here, this is a wonderful breakthrough. Politically, I think I probably would have preferred it to be a Colin Powell or Condoleezza Rice on issues. But this is a great moment, and I think we should all cheer it. And I would say to conservatives who may think that this wasn't a significant election, I would say, look, you know, we should all be up there cheering that moment because it's going to be really a very important one for America on January 20th. Barack Obama won. He's not a Muslim. He's not a socialist. Mm. He's not a demon. He's our president.
Deborah Dickerson, you've watched it as an American, as an African American. How are you taking on this vote for Barack Obama, president-elect, at the end of this week?
How in how it could be seriously denied that this represents a mandate and a demand on the part of Americans for change is, I guess it's sort of like people, you know, accidentally belching. We should just politely ignore it. It's odd, though. I spend my life writing about race, and I was talking to my mom, who's 86 and yeah. Mississippi sharecropper with mm-hmm. no education, and she and I were both, we're not crying and hugging, and we're glad. It's wonderful. I never talk to my two biracial children about race just because I want to spare them as long as I can, but I did talk to them about race after Obama was elected, but I'm not dancing in the streets. The tears of joy aren't there for me, but it's wonderful. It reaches me to my soul, but it actually makes me feel very, very serious. This is such a critical moment. It's not clear if any president could fix the economy, the war, those things, but Barack Obama is the only president who has a real hope of moving us forward on race and issues of social justice. And I just feel so eagle-eyed and focused and serious about that I'm waiting for the We Are the World choruses to stop and for us to roll up our sleeves and go, okay, how do we do this now?
Right. Jack Beatty, we'll look at the agenda. We'll look at the mandate. But first, still, just on the vote itself, Ron Brownstein writes in the National Journal this week that a new Democratic coalition has been born with this vote. He says Obama won the most decisive Democratic victory in a generation, largely by tapping into growing pieces of American society, young people, growing by definition, Hispanics and other minorities, white upper middle class professionals, interesting. He calls it a coalition of the ascendant, along with the huge margins from African Americans. And he's quoting here Simon Rosenberg saying Democrats are surging with all the ascending and growing parts of the electorate. He, Obama, is building a coalition that Democrats could ride for 30 or 40 years, the way they rode the FDR coalition of the 1930s. What do you think, Jack? Karl Rove was talking about like that and about the permanent Republican majority not so long ago. Do you see something that durable here or not?
Well, you know, everyone from John Meacham to Karl Rove is saying, don't forget, we're a center-right nation in the face of those facts you just named, center-right nation, and the fact that the Pew poll shows majorities of 58 to 35 say that government should guarantee health care for all U.S. citizens, even if it means raising taxes. Center-right nation, even in the face of polls showing expanded environmental protection, infrastructure investment, basically the elements of the progressive platform are embraced by majorities of the American public. So it is the racial breakthrough of this moment can't be exaggerated, but it's also a breakthrough for progressivism in America. That's the moment. The public seems to want it, at least to judge by these polls, and there seems to be a coalition being put together that could deliver it, a coalition anchored on one coast by Florida, on the other by California, and cemented by a surge in Hispanic votes for Obama, 66% for Obama. That's the growing segment of the electorate. Young people by, 29% for Obama, another growing segment of the population. And then you have professionals. For the first time in 2004, Democrats captured the vote of professionals. Big category includes teachers, but a lot of other people. And they increased that this time around. These are elements that could provide the basis for a realignment to the Democrats.
Let's listen to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. This is a news conference on Wednesday, the morning, the day after the vote, describing a new agenda now that Barack Obama has been elected president.
The agenda as we go forward, as you know, has always been about, again, growing our economy, expanding access to health care, improving the quality of education for all Americans, ending our dependence on foreign oil, and bringing an end to the war in Iraq. And again, in a bipartisan way, we'll be discussing these issues as we go forward.
In a bipartisan way, says Nancy Pelosi, Bill McKenzie, Jack describes a kind of a new axis from California through Florida and some new states, certainly important states, in the blue column right across the country. Give us the Texas perspective here. Do you see a breakthrough for progressivism in this election, or still the center-right nation that many Republicans now describe?
Well, I think we're getting ready to find out. And I think that's one of the gambles of Barack Obama is to figure out which one he may be, because to some extent he kind of campaigned both as a centrist and as a progressive. And I would argue, not surprisingly, I think his success is going to come if he is able to find the center. And I would suggest on Ms. Pelosi was talking about health care. Well, there are people like Jim Cooper from Tennessee, who's a moderate Democratic congressman who I believe endorsed Obama. Who had offered a centrist alternative to Hillary care back in the early 1990s. We'll talk to him. Go work with him some to help build a coalition from the center. The good news on education is there actually is kind of a – this is one area where we've had a lot of bipartisanship. There seems to be some common agreement that we want to see schools held accountable. We want to pay teachers for performance. We want to attract teachers, pay them and attract them into schools that are challenging schools and reward them and put more federal money into schools. So I think there's some ideas that lots of people can get behind, and I think Barack Obama is absolutely right on trying to talk about early childhood. That's a place where spending will make sense. So if he's smart, no offense to my pal Jack, I think he will try to move it from the center and working some people like Susan Collins from Maine, Republican, Evan Bayh from Indiana, work with him. And also, let's don't forget John McCain, who said right out of the chute after the election that he hopes to work with President Obama once he gets back up to the Senate. So immigration is so divisive, maybe we shouldn't touch that in the first 6 months, but in the first year, we certainly should. John McCain would be a good person to work with. And last thing I'll say is John McCain actually could be a person he could work with on Iraq, surprisingly.
We'll talk about it. Here's John McCain on election night.
I wish Godspeed to the man who was my former opponent and will be my president. And I call on all Americans, as I have often in this campaign, to not despair of our present difficulties, but to believe always in the promise and greatness of America.
John McCain on election night, might he play a role in a Barack Obama administration? Bill McKenzie in Dallas, Deborah Dickerson in Albany, New York. Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're looking at a week in the news, the week we've picked a new president-elect Barack Obama. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a week in the news, the week the country has picked a new president, president-elect Obama. Here's President Bush at the White House yesterday with his whole cabinet beside him, pledging a smooth transition for President Obama. He said the wheels are already in motion.
We provided intelligence briefings to the president-elect, and the Department of Justice has approved security clearances for members of his transition team. In the coming weeks, we will ask administration officials to brief the Obama team on ongoing policy issues, ranging from the financial markets to the war in Iraq.
And here's Illinois Congressman Rahm Emanuel, was offered the chief of staff job by Obama, took a little while to decide, finally accepted, critics complaining he may be too partisan. Here's Emanuel.
I got a lot to weigh, my commitment to my country, my commitment to public service and why I got into this, as well as my commitment to my family and what I want to do as a parent.
He's been there before with the Clinton administration, knew how to knock heads and line things up on Capitol Hill. A tough guy. Deborah Dickerson, what do you think Barack Obama's tapping of Rahm Emanuel means about the flavor of the White House we're going to see and the agenda? Does it tell us something about the agenda he may pursue, the speed with which he may pursue it?
I think there were a lot of complaints of people during the campaign that he was too genteel. And I think one of the things, you should take the gloves off and get in there and mix it up some more. And obviously,
that Obama
was right.
Should. Mm-hmm.
That Obama should. So mm-hmm. obviously he was right and they were wrong. But I think choosing somebody with the reputation and the track record that Rahm Emanuel has is a signal that maybe he does know that he's going to have to mix it up some and that he's getting surrogates who could do that for him. I've been reading up on him the last couple of days, and apparently he's pretty feisty. So I think the signal is, I think what he's saying is, I understand that it's not easy to make the trains of government run on time. And while it may have been more or less a consensus-driven kind of campaign, more grassrootsy, I think he's looking to run a very efficient and a very efficient but no-nonsense kind of administration. And I think Emmanuel's choice is basically, here's the guy that's going to keep me from being too wishy-washy.
Yeah, well, that's his reputation for the Jack. Yeah. What do you see in the team names being floated, Jack?
Well, Paul Begala, as is his wont, came up, I thought, with the best description of Emmanuel. He said that in point of his personality, he's a combination of, quote, a toothache and a hemorrhoid. he is one tough guy. He has a brother in Hollywood with whom he has honed his aggression over the years. And he's known for that. You know, when he was in the Clinton White House, he was a centrist. In fact, he was a sort of member of the right of the Clinton administration. And a lot of people criticized him at the time and felt that he was pushing Clinton too far in that direction. But he's a very effective man. And it also, I think it shows, as others have pointed out, Obama means to win. I mean, he plays to win.
Yes.
He talks lofty, and he is lofty. He's also a Chicago Paul, and I think this signals I'm going to do what it takes.
And he did just win. Obama press conference this afternoon, sitting down with economic advisors this morning. Bill McKenzie, let's look at team and direction. I mean, here's Obama sitting down on his kind of, the first day of the rest of his life with Warren Buffett, former Treasury Secretaries Robert Rubin and Larry Summers. Paul Volcker, of course, the former Federal Reserve Chairman, who was so vaunted back in the early 80s. Eric Schmidt, Chief Executive of Google, is in on this meeting, as well as Antonio Villaraigosa, the mayor of Los Angeles, and Governor Jennifer Granholm of Michigan. What's the economic flavor you see in today's Obama sit down there, Bill?
Well, those are good people, and that's a good team to have around him. Here's what I would like to see. You know, there's probably a case for another stimulus package after he becomes president. We should wait and see.
Before there's talk of $100 billion being put up to President Bush before.
Yeah, I would wait. I would wait until afterwards, because we do have to see how this, you know, the $700 billion to a trillion that we've already pumped in the economy, you know, give it a little bit more time to work. However, having said that, if you listen to today's news, that retail sector, manufacturing sectors aren't doing well. Mm. And so in the short term, there's perhaps a case that you need to pump some more money in the economy so we can go out and buy what retailers want to sell and what manufacturers make.
Quarter million jobs lost last month,
right.
240,000.
But here's my quid pro quo. In return for that short term, we should have a long-term aspect to this too. And what I would like to see is the Warren Buffett particularly assert himself here, because he, along with Pete Peterson, have been trying to draw attention to the fact that we are going to have an enormous entitlement overload unless we do something about it. Mm. We're going to looking at I've brought this up here before. I'm bringing it up again.
Yep.
A $53 trillion debt unless we do something about Medicare first and Social Security second. And Medicare is coming due in a decade. So I would love to see a quid pro quo package. Short term, we could have some sort of stimulus. Over long term, let's appoint a commission that is going to come back with ideas for President-elect Obama to sign off on Medicare. And if he does so, then Congress signs off on it. And if neither sign off on it, an automatic set of reforms go into place. I would love to see that kind of package brought out.
Could you see John McCain somehow getting in here with Barack Obama, really working with him either in a position in this administration or just as a partner on Capitol Hill after the defeat he just took? What do you think?
I wouldn't see bring him in the administration, and if I were in Obama's shoes, I wouldn't do that either. Abraham Lincoln notwithstanding, who brought in his opponents. But I think, you know, you do need allies up on Capitol Hill. And oddly enough, I mean, one of the attractive features about McCain, I'm not trying to replay the election, but one of the attractive features was he was the guy who had done what Obama said he wanted to do. He had his entire career. He worked with people like Ted Kennedy, Russ Feingold, all these people we've heard about. So I see no reason why McCain can't work with him in areas that McCain has some expertise. And
Jack,
he does. McCain does care about long-term entitlement reform.
Let's look on around the block, Jack. At the Pentagon, there's the talk. Robert Gates may stay right there. David Petraeus, of course, CENTCOM chief, right there. We could have some continuity on that front. We don't know.
During the campaign, Obama said some good things about Gates, and Gates is a very sound man. I mean, he earned his reputation, I think, in the first Bush administration, and I think that would be a very good idea to keep him on for a while. You know, for Treasury, you're hearing about former Clinton Treasury Secretary Larry Summers. he would have some difficulties given his problem at Harvard, where he seemed to be saying that women didn't have the makings to be scientists. That would be controversial. Another person you hear brought up is the New York Federal Reserve Chairman Timothy Geithner, mm-hmm. a new name to me entirely.
Young guy.
But someone who apparently was pretty prescient about the financial crisis. And down the line, to me, one of the great mentioners, most intriguing mention, is of Colin Powell, the Secretary of Education. I've heard people brew at that. This is something he's been very concerned with in his Meet the Press interview.
Education. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he came out strongly on that subject.
Ken Duberstein saying, forget about it in the New York Times, but maybe.
Yeah, maybe. you never know. And then you hear for other offices, Janet Napolitano, Governor of Arizona for Attorney General, and Governor Vilsack of Iowa as very likely Agriculture Secretary, and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as Environmental Secretary. So some stars being mentioned along with people we don't know for the cabinet.
Deborah, do you think that we can read from the names that Obama puts up there what direction it's going to be on centrist, progressive, you name it? Paul Krugman writing today, you might say the only thing he has to fear is fear itself. We'll be able to get a compass reading? Will we be able to, Deborah, from the team on whether it's going to be Clinton-style sort of triangulation or some new Obama-style New Deal?
I always hate it when people say that's a good question. But, yeah, that's a really good question.
There we go. Darn it, a good question.
Yeah, but I think that it's really just too soon to say, and I do think, to get back to the earlier question, that he is, I think we can expect something New Deal-like. I think we need something New Deal-like. And I think Obama is uniquely situated to, and I'll just kind of say this crudely, to pass progressivism off as is not so progressive. You know, I think he'll be able to
reframe it.
Right. And I think he'll be able to do that because of the unique set of circumstances we find ourselves in. And there's a real sort of leveling of the class structure here because the boat is sinking. And so many of us are, you know, I'm a successful author, but, you know, I find myself applying for what I call poor people's health insurance, you know, because after years of paying $1,000 a month out of my pocket and on plastic, I can't do it anymore. So here I sit in a grimy inner city office applying for health insurance. And it occurs to me that the crisis we're facing it is a great class leveler, and I think that's one of the reasons he was able to bring together so many disparate parts of the economy and get people to see past the sort of superficial things that divide them, and also get people to see that if I was middle class or upper middle class, well, gee, look at me now. My home's foreclosed. I have no health insurance.
Watch out.
So I think that things that might have seemed very radical and were easy to have dismissed as socialism or that sort of thing, I think is going to be more palatable, and God knows he's the king of rhetoric, so I think he can diffuse some of these terms and get people to look past this label, progressive, left, socialist, and say, I think that any American who doesn't have a great deal of suspicion about the government's ability to protect us from the worst excesses of capitalism and make more people palatable to the notion that there is a role for government in assuring some baselines. If you don't understand that after the last few years, I just don't think that's going to be a very hard sell. So I guess I'm hoping for something New Deal-like.
A new day, a tough day, and it's right in front of us right now. We've got our listeners banging at the gates. Let's go to Heartland, Vermont, and Anais. Anais, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, panel.
Hi.
I wanted to share some comments. I am an older biracial woman, and so race has always shaped my life in many uncomfortable ways. Because there's no place to really be in this country. You don't belong anywhere if you're a biracial person. I think it's
except incredible. The White House now, maybe.
Well,
or maybe you
belong there you
everywhere.
Go. There you go. At least there's some place to call home.
You can lay your head.
I'm very excited by what has happened, and I think it is a great first step towards bridging a lot of difficult past in this country, and I'm excited by that. I think he is the best man for the job, and what is most exciting to me was that enough people felt that way to vote for their interests first, and to have race perhaps be not a factor at all, or maybe a secondary factor. I would love to say that I hope we continue as an electorate now that we have access, because I think what has happened here is we have been put in a position where we have access once again to a more representative form of government, which we have not had for ages, that we push for what we need, and if it looks like a New Deal and if it looks like socialism, who cares? We've got to get ourselves understanding that we're in this all together. So I'm excited, and I hope everybody remembers that this is just the beginning. We have a heck of a lot of work to do.
We sure do. Anais, we're glad to have your voice right here. Thanks so much for calling. Let's get another right here from Buffalo, New York. And Lou, you're on the air.
Yes. Thank you, Tom, for taking the call. Just very simply put, I'm 57 years old. 1968, I was 17 years old. Mm. And for me, Barack Obama is the Bobby Kennedy I never had.
Yeah. The one who got away.
What? Well, I'm sorry, what's that?
The one who got away, in a sense, or the one who could never be there.
Exactly. Yes, indeed.
I'll take that as applause from Buffalo, and thanks very much, Lou, for calling. Let's get one from Somerville, Massachusetts. And Matt, you're on the air.
Hello, everyone.
Hi.
Hi.
From my experience has been that the comedy and humor has been the source of my news for the last couple of years, and true to form, The Onion had the best headline. I'll read their little paragraph. After Obama was elected, the headline was, "Black man given nation's worst job."
Congratulations.
Barack Obama, 47, was given the least desirable job in the entire country Tuesday when he was elected President of the United States. In his new high-stress, low-reward position, Obama will be charged with such tasks as completely overhauling the nation's broken-down economy, repairing the crumbling infrastructure, and generally having to please more than 300 million Americans and cater to their every whim on a daily basis.
Good luck to you, mister.
As part of his duties, the black man will have to spend 4 to 8 years cleaning up the messes other people left behind.
Oh, boy. Matt, you're right. Humor has been a great saving grace coming all the way through this, and we're glad. Thank you so much for sharing that. Let me get one more right here from Charleston, South Carolina. Ken, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you know, Ken?
Great show. Listen, I slightly disagree with an earlier caller that said that Obama should mix it up. I don't really think he should. He has always exuded an acute strength in his quiet and constant presence, and that's been such a contrast to the what I think is a bombastic bluster of the bring-it-on mentality.
Mm-hmm.
Obama has always been very constant and very strong. I'm a martial artist, and the toughest martial artists are also the quietest guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think that Obama has an enormous internal strength and integrity that will see him through some very tough times, as he's demonstrated. In addition, when I say about this health care program, I've been involved in economic development for a while, and tax incentivization, stimulus packages, et cetera, have been used in economic development.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that a national health care system would serve like an enormous economic development mechanism for the entire nation. In the same way that Social Security took the burden of elder care off of families, a health care program in this United States would allow individual people and businesses to have a real stimulus in their business format that no one has really talked about, the economic development potential of a health care plan.
Ken, our martial arts Sifu, you may be thinking like an Obaman right there. We'll see soon enough from the team he's putting together. Bill McKenzie, I want to come back and ask you after a short break here about how you see the economic options here, and as a kind of moderate, conservative, you know, whether you, as Deborah Dickerson says, whether you may be open to some new framing of progressive ideas, given the challenges that we're looking at right now in the economy. Bill, stand by in Dallas, Deborah in Albany, New York, and Jack Beatty. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It was Obama all over the world this week. In France, a sense of awe.
We are looking at the United States with a new regard, with a new look, with a new in a new manner. It's something really amazing.
For one Beijing woman in China, skin color, color skin, she says, was a big factor, and she wanted Americans to know it.
I think that your color skin give you some advantages, and that will bring help to a lot of people around the world who are not white skin.
And in Kogelo, Kenya, the home of Obama's Kenyan dad, they were singing in celebration for a new hometown hero. Obama, the chanting there. We're looking at a week in the news. The week we've picked a new president, President-elect Obama. Bill McKenzie joins us from the Dallas Morning News. Deborah Dickerson is here from Mother Jones Magazine, author of The End of Blackness and An American Story. Jack Beatty's here. Bill McKenzie, I want to come to you on this issue of the economy. I mean, the markets, you know, had some really rough days this week. As you said, all kinds of new numbers still coming out that look bad, if not, you know, terrible. We may still be going down the chutes a bit here. How radically do you think an Obama administration needs to be thinking about spending, about bringing it back, about changing the way we've been doing business to get out of this ditch, Bill?
Well, first let me say about this challenge he has. You know, the really great ones love these moments. And that's one thing I like about Obama. He's kind of like Larry Bird. You remember Larry Bird used to always say he wanted the ball for that last shot in the playoffs. And the really great ones want these moments. They want to rise to them, and there's something in them that that kind of feed off of these challenges. So,
Rahm Emanuel saying in the last day or two, crisis means opportunity.
Right, right. So having said that, to some extent, Deborah and the caller from Vermont are right. No matter whether – if Obama is successful after 4 years, it doesn't matter what you call it, whether you call it progressivism or New Dealism, whatever it is. If our economy is in a good shape and if we're at peace in the world, then that's a good thing, no matter what you call it. However, here's what I would caution. If you look at where European nations have been going over the last 15 to 20 years, they have been moving largely away from building up government's role in their economy. And I am not arguing against a safety net at all. I'm not arguing against a degree of social welfareism. It's degree to which we have it. And if you look at all these economies, France, Germany, Britain, all of these have been moving more towards market economies. And if you look at India and China and you look at what they're trying to do and you look at where the global economy is going, I would just caution how far we go in trying to build up the state's role in our larger economy. Having said that, I'm going to backtrack again to education. To me, this is an area where it really does make sense to spend because I think this is one of the areas that is the underpinnings of so many parts of our economy, whether that's preparing people for the workforce, whether it's going to even help us understand new medical technologies and ways to innovate within healthcare. So to me, I'm open and good with spending on that in that area. As I said earlier, I think it's perhaps going to be necessary to have some further stimulus plan. However, we just can't be laying ourselves with more and more and more debt. And while I heard the caller's point from South Carolina, he makes a good point. And at some level, I don't agree with him. I'm sure it probably would help us. But we're talking about having a national health care system in his eyes that would go from people from 25 to 64. And we're barely able to afford the one we're going to have for seniors from 65 over going forward. So how are we going to absorb that cost as well as pay for this other one? And I think that Obama is going to come really face-to-face with this challenge of long-term debt sooner than he may anticipate.
But we hear a real openness there from you, Bill, out of Dallas to pragmatism.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And if you even look, if I may say so, for Bush, I mean, he's been somewhat pragmatic. A colleague of mine said that, you know, he was elected a social conservative. He goes out a conservative socialist. I mean, he's the guy approving close to $1 trillion in the economy. So you have to have some degree of pragmatism to be able to save and prop up your economy. But again, over the long term, let's look at the way the world markets are moving. They aren't moving towards necessarily New Dealism.
Jack, what do you see here in this span, pragmatism to dogmatism and everything in between? Where are you putting your flag, Jack?
With pragmatism, but I do believe pragmatism now calls for a much more active government. It calls for an active government and regulation. We just saw what the lack of that does. And across the board in these social programs, to repeat, Obama was elected to do something about the gap in opportunity in America, about the fading middle class. Inequality was a central part, addressing inequality, of his platform. Now, these European nations are being forced, I agree with Bill, by the nature of the international economy to change the balance somewhat within their polities. The fact remains the quality of life is higher in Europe. The fact remains that inequality is much less. When Europeans look at our nation, they see this vast expanse, this gap between rich and poor. And they notice, by the way, that how heavily the poor are minority. And they say, is that capitalism? Is that what it produces? If that's what it is, we want something a little more balanced. Mm-hmm. And I think the key to Obama's personality, I think, as to his politics, is the word balance. And he has said again and again there has been an imbalance toward the wealthy, toward unfettered markets.
In policy, toward
that. And I think just as his temperament seeks balance between opposites, so I think here he looks for a new balance in the American economy with an emphasis on government programs looking downward to help people come up.
I think Deborah's right. He may take it out of political terms in some ways, put it in practical terms. He's very good at doing that. Of course, there's been such pushback, though, against Obama from the right even before he takes office. You wonder, even if it's pragmatic, how it may be received. Let's go to River Edge, New Jersey. George, you're on the air.
Hello, gentlemen.
Hi.
Thanks for the opportunity to say hello.
Gentlemen and lady, her madam herself, Deborah Dickerson.
Thank you, Deborah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I've had my radio turned down. I must have missed her. Ha-ha. Here's my plea for President-elect Obama. I would say to him, go on television once a week and debunk what's going to come out of the, quote, conservative talk radio. I call it hate radio, and debunk their half-truths and their alarmism and their, oh, you think you're using the word socialism? Wait till you hear what they are going to say. And I think the uphill battle of explaining our current situation and what has to be done to the American people is simply going to take a lot of work. And I think any politician would feel people are going to get, quote, tired of hearing my voice, you know, but I think it has to be done. There's a simplicity, there's a distressing simplicity to the way we look at issues nowadays.
Mm.
You people this morning have gone into some detail, but whether you know it or not, you've done it to a degree that's a lot more deep than the 6 o'clock news.
So bring on the fireside chat and bring it on every week, you say, George.
Yeah, I think so. Now, the radio broadcasts, presidents and even mayors have weekly radio broadcasts, but their listenership is really kind of low. You can't make people watch TV, but do it with some, you know, graphics. Explain the details. The devil is always in the details.
Yeah,
let people commandeer our language and just call it socialist and then dismiss it. That's just going to be, well, we'll be back in the same boat that we're in.
George, you're great, and it's very thought-provoking. On the other hand, who can get half an hour a week or even 5 minutes a week on national television? Deborah Dickerson, that was a one big spend by Barack Obama a couple days before the vote. But can even the United States president get the equivalent of what FDR had in his fireside chats anymore? Is that even out there?
Maybe via the internet. He couldn't come up with it depends on exactly what the caller's talking about. But if he's talking about a half hour debunking things, I think probably
or
the
just
way
explaining.
To do that.
Mm-hmm.
Podcast and the internet would probably be a good way to do it, but I can't imagine how he could just logistically work out going on weekly. And I'm sure the caller would probably agree that it would need to be weekly. It would need to be as things arose. I don't know that it could be done, but probably he's got young people. Hopefully he'll bring a lot of young people into his administration and salt it throughout all levels of government, and they could find a way to make a weekly podcast or some weekly internet. He could do the first president to do YouTube regularly.
Yeah.
And if he made it interesting enough, people would watch, and certainly we journalists would pick it up and link to it and talk about it. But a regular television presence, it's all about the Benjamins.
Right, right. And the YouTube president might be an answer. Bill, I think George is really onto something here, though. I mean, there is, we're one little boat in a great big ocean. There is a lot of radio and right-leaning radio out there, for example, that is just incredibly, intensely opposed to Obama before he even takes office, talking about resist from the first minute, resist to the you know, your last breath. How do we get a better conversation toward the pragmatism you're describing?
Well, one, I would say I don't know the fairness doctrine well, but I doubt very seriously Obama could go do that for a weekly broadcast on national television without giving, you know, 30 minutes to Republicans or whatever. But I'd also say this.
Do that. Why not?
Well, yeah, but I'd say even if he could, I wouldn't do it. Because, look, Barack Obama, what did he end up with? 300 and whatever electoral college votes. He got 52% of
– 360-some now big.
Right. He won. Rush Limbaugh didn't win. And so go play your game, Obama. As I go back to that earlier, go find those moderates in the Republican Party. Start working with them. To some extent, don't dignify Rush and all the other chatters right now. You won. He's not Bill Clinton. He's not in there with 43% of the vote. He's in there with 52% of the vote. So play to your strength. You don't have to worry about that. I would argue that the discussion has to be to take place within conservatism and within the Republican Party. And so, you know, what I'm looking for are those progressive conservatives who are going to start standing forth, like McCain had in his career, like Bush ran on in 2000, and no, he didn't perfectly govern that way, but those who will stand up and articulate a vision that will be good on spending, that will reach Latinos who shouldn't be running away from the Republican Party and the numbers they are running away from, given their cultural preferences, who wins back suburbanites with a smart message about education, who plays to the younger evangelicals who are not culture warriors. They vote Republican. They are not Democrats, but they aren't on board with the Dobsons, et cetera, when it comes to things like gay marriage. Talk to those folks. Build a coalition around them. As Margaret Spellings, education sector, I interviewed this week, go back to being different kinds of Republicans. And that's the discussion we need to have.
Let's get Pawtucket, Rhode Island on right here. And Josh. Hi, Josh. You're on the air.
Hello, and hello to the panel. Can you hear me?
Yes, Josh. Yes. You're on, my friend.
All right. Let me tell you why I'm so excited and optimistic, especially in such dark times. There is anybody with answers and a way to communicate those answers can be taken seriously. And in these dark times, with the economy falling, you know, the stock market falling 1,000 points in 2 days again, anybody who, with the Obama team, can put forward answers, and the whole country will listen. In especially in dark times, This can give us social change and economic change that we could have never had in the golden age just, 6 months ago.
Sounds in some ways like you're on with Bill McKenzie saying to Obama, lead, just lead, go for it. Let's go to Mike in Fairfield, Iowa. Mike, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'm concerned about the possibility of rolling job losses across the nation with the way things are going. I know I feel a lot of optimism with Obama in there and the excitement, but I think we got to face the reality real soon and start coming up with some solutions because we're going to have a lot of unemployment to deal with. I'm college educated, but if I were in this country and only had a high school diploma, I would be very worried.
You in that situation and a lot of others. Mike, thanks for your call. Jack, those numbers are real that keep coming out.
They are. Unemployment now highest in 16 years, and probably more bad news ahead. But, Tom, let me just return to something you mentioned earlier, the gay marriage vote in California, the vote of the voters to take, of the majority, to take a right away from the minority, the right to marry, which had been granted
to them. In the California Constitution, now,
you know, this was a real defeat for equal rights in America, just at a moment when equal rights were being vindicated with the election of an African-American president. And, you know, it's happened before in America, that a right, that majorities have taken rights away from minorities. It happened in the South. It happened in the disenfranchising conventions from Mississippi in 1889 to Oklahoma in 1910 that effectively removed, installed in the Southern state constitutions poll taxes and literacy tests, and effectively ended the vote for African-American citizens. It happened then, and we look back on it and we say, shameful. How could America have done that? And I know in my bones that we will look back upon this victory for what I think is bigotry in California and elsewhere and say, how could Americans have done that?
Bigotry or democracy?
I really got to jump in on this point. One of the ways I think Obama can move us forward on race is he's in a position to make black people, it was 71 or 77% of blacks voted against or voted
against
to take
marriage,
away.
Yep.
Right. That's an amazing statistic. And Obama needs to make black people answer the question of, are you talking about, when you say civil rights, do you really only mean black rights? Because that question needs to be put out there. And I think black people's feet needs to get held to the fire on race, just like everybody else's. You know, I think we need to have the conversation about what comes out of our pulpits and about homophobia and sexism. And I think that blacks have been allowed to hide behind this umbrella where we get to make these demands, but no one gets to, and we explain yourself, why are so many blacks disproportionately incarcerated and that sort of thing. We formulate those questions. But I don't think that we should be allowed to talk about civil rights when all we really mean is black rights. And he's the only kind of person who can make us have that conversation.
Well, let's hope for a new candor on all kinds of fronts with Barack Obama in the White House. And soon it will be an exciting time to air things in a new way. Deborah Dickerson with us today from Albany, New York, author of The End of Blackness. Deborah, thank you so much for joining us.
This was fun.
Bill McKenzie, editorial columnist at the Dallas Morning News. Always great to have you, Bill. Thank you very much for being here this week today.
Thank you all. Exciting times.
Yes, they are indeed. Jack Beatty, great to have you right here.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.